Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict calls for an urgent dialogue between the opposing sides in Ivory Coast to end the nation's slide towards civil war. Overlooked crisis. With more than 1 million people in the Ivory Coast having fled their homes, we speak to a Catholic aid worker who's just returned from the area about this underreported humanitarian crisis. JP2 Countdown. This week sees the 6th anniversary of Pope John Paul's death, just weeks ahead of his beatification. And we speak to a leading Catholic commentator about his memories of the late Pope and that extraordinary April in 2005. And looking at Libya. In the wake of the military intervention in Libya, we examine the ongoing violence and upheaval in the region and ask how it is likely to play out and impact on the area's Christians. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict launched an appeal for an urgent dialogue between the opposing sides in Ivory Coast to end the worsening violence in the West African nation. Emma McCarthy reports.
Speaking in French to the thousands gathered beneath a warm spring sun in St. Peter's Square this Wednesday, Pope Benedict launched the following urgent appeal.
Depuis longtemps, ma pensée va souvent aux populations de la Côte d'Ivoire.
He said, for some time now, my thoughts have turned often to the people of Ivory Coast, traumatized by painful internal strife and serious social and political tensions. The Holy Father expressed his closeness to all those who have lost a loved one and are suffering from violence, while he urgently appealed for a process of constructive dialogue for the common good. He said the dramatic opposition makes the restoration of respect and peaceful coexistence even more urgent, and added that no effort should be spared in this regard.
Avec ma bénédiction.
Earlier, continuing his cycle of lessons on the doctors of the Church, Pope Benedict told believers that prayer and confession are the best antidotes to our era marked by signs of loss of conscience and morality. Outlining the legacy of an 18th century Neapolitan saint, Alphonsus Liguori, the Holy Father spoke of the obvious lack of esteem for the sacrament of confession among Catholics today and urged priests to adopt a more charitable, understanding and gentle attitude towards penitence, while always remaining faithful to Catholic moral teaching.
Alphonsus left a brilliant career as a lawyer to become a priest and greatly contributed to the renewal of the church in his native Naples. He began as a missionary among the urban poor, gathering small groups for prayer and instruction in the faith. Broadening his pastoral outreach, he founded the Congregation of the Mori Host Redeemer, the Redemptoris, as a group of itinerant missionaries.
The Holy Father said that Alphonsus's pastoral zeal also found expression in his moral teaching, which emphasized divine mercy and the relationship between God's law and our deepest human needs and aspirations.
May this great doctor of the Church, venerated also as a pattern of moral theologians, help us to respond even more fully to God's call to grow in holiness, and inspire in priests, religious and laity, a firm commitment to the new evangelization.
Finally, Pope Benedict greeted all those English-speaking pilgrims present at Wednesday's audience. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Upon all of you, God invokes the Lord's blessings of joy and peace.
More More than 1 million people have fled their homes to flee the violence and chaos in a nation that appears to be slowly sliding towards a full-scale civil war. But just in case any of you are wondering, we're not talking about Libya, but about the situation in the Ivory Coast, which was the subject of the Pope's appeal on Wednesday. Despite this dramatic situation, little attention is being paid by the international media to this underreported and worsening humanitarian crisis caused by this massive displacement of people. Many of those Ivorians fleeing their homes have crossed the border into neighbouring Liberia to take refuge there. One person who has just spent 10 days in the border area between Liberia and the Ivory Coast is Antonio Cabral, the regional manager for West Africa for the Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD. He told me more about the extent of this overlooked crisis.
Well, the situation is very serious because basically what we are witnessing is civil war in Ivory Coast, and people are fleeing conflict, and when this happens, basically they flee with nothing, so they're basically running for their lives, and so the needs are huge. People are in need of food, people are in need of shelter, so they basically need everything.
So people there are pretty much resigned to the fact that their country is sliding into full-scale civil war?
I don't think the people are resigned to that fact. I think they still hope that, you know, there will be some kind of solution that would avoid, you know, full-scale civil war. Unfortunately, all the signs at the moment are on the opposite direction, that, you know, we're moving in Ivory Coast to a full-scale civil war.
This is a huge humanitarian crisis, yet it's going largely unreported in the international media, only getting very scarce coverage because of the conflict in Libya and the disaster in Japan. So, I mean, is it just been totally forgotten about?
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid that, you know, the media doesn't seem to have space for a big humanitarian crisis in Ivory Coast. Maybe because there is no oil, or maybe because the other two crises in Libya and Japan have caught all the headlines, and that there seems to be no space. But it is a huge crisis, as you said, and it is very important that we raise the profile to this crisis, because people are suffering and in need of help.
And are you getting the funding that this crisis deserves? And are other NGOs saying that they are managing to get the funding, given, as you say, this is a particularly unfortunate period when there's so many international crises going on in our world?
It is very difficult to get the funding, and UN itself is struggling to get the funding. They had an appeal, UNHCR had an appeal, and they are struggling to get, I think they managed to get about 30% of the funding only. So the whole general economic crisis in the world, plus the two big stories that we have at the moment, are making it very difficult to find the funding to respond to it. CAFOD, in its little way, has been able to respond and is responding with our own funds.
And what are you doing actually to help on the ground? Can you tell us briefly about that?
Okay, we are basically working with refugees that have fled to Liberia. About 90,000, over 90,000 refugees have crossed the border from Ivory Coast into Liberia. It is, in many ways, a very interesting story, because refugees are being welcomed in Liberia by host families, and families are actually receiving them very well. And this has to do with the history of Liberians having fled in the past to Ivory Coast, so there's a bit of a return of favour being done. But these families that are hosting refugees are themselves very poor, and they're running out of food stocks. As you can imagine, the houses are very crowded and in need of shelter. In one of the villages that we are working, called Glale, near the border between Liberia and Ivory Coast, the population has more than doubled in the last few weeks. And that has put a huge pressure on these Liberian families that are willing to welcome the refugees. So we are supporting them with food, with seeds, with latrines, so sanitation, access to clean water. So this is what we're doing at the moment.
Now, you say that these families, despite being very poor themselves, are welcoming these refugees, but the leaders of Liberia are already beginning to express doubt if this influx of refugees becomes larger and larger, and they're worried about the impact it could have on their own country, which also has conflict, of course.
I mean, Liberia is a very small country, has a population of about 3 million, and Ivory Coast itself is a huge country compared with a population over 20 million. And certainly there are thresholds where things will become very, very difficult in Liberia. At the moment, the worst case scenario, we think that maybe 250,000 to half a million people could cross the border, and that would be a huge strain for Liberia's government and into the Liberia population. But, you know, at the moment it's still just about manageable.
Now, did you actually get to speak to any of the refugees? And if you did, what did they say? What are their feelings now? Do they nurse any hopes that they can go home sometime soon?
Well, they don't know for how long they'll have to be there. I think, you know, from their experience, from what happened in Liberia, where some of the refugees stayed in Ivory Coast for 10 years, 14 years. I spoke with someone who hosted a Liberian refugee for 14 years in the past. They don't really know how long it's going to be. They obviously hope that they can go back as soon as possible.
And what are the greatest needs of these people, if you had to single out just a few things?
I think medical care, water, sanitation, shelter. You know, Liberia is one of the wettest countries in the world, is the second wettest. And the rainy season will start in a couple of months, and shelter will become very important.
Could more have been done to try to, shall we say, avert this slide into full-scale civil war? I mean, the Ivory Coast was once known as a bastion of peace and stability in Western Africa, and yet now?
Yeah, I mean, the crisis in Ivory Coast is not new. I mean, it's a crisis that's been ongoing for the last 10 years or so, and very little has been done to try to get a solution. I think, and we feel in CAFOD that we still believe that people like the ECOWAS, the West Africa States Economic Community, or even the African Union could have a word and try to mediate the conflict. The internal politics is very complex. It's not as easy as it might sound. And the fact that the country seems to be divided into really is not good. Is not good news. But it is, as you said, you know, a country that was known to be one of the success stories in West Africa, and it's a pity that it's being destroyed by this unrest.
I was speaking to Antonio Cabral of the Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD.
John Paul II, he loves you.
This week sees the sixth anniversary of the death of Pope John Paul II and the release of updated information concerning the logistics for his beatification ceremony on May the 1st. Church organisers say they're expecting at least 300,000 people to attend the beatification mass in and around St. Peter's Square, but say the Eternal City is ready to welcome other pilgrims who want to come to Rome. They deny earlier press reports that every hotel is booked out.
The world needs more than just social reformers. It needs saints.
The much-loved Polish-born Pope, who shortly will be declared a blessed, died on April the 2nd, 2005. All those who were in Rome at the time vividly recall the extraordinary scenes when millions of mourners flocked to the city from all over the world to pay their respects to his body. John Allen works for the National Catholic Reporter and is one of the US's leading commentators on Catholic affairs. He looks back at the figure of the late Pope and shares with us his own memories of that extraordinary April 6 years ago.
Well, I think for those of us who watched those events unfold in Rome, the kind of indelible impression that stays with you is just that tidal wave of humanity that poured through the streets of Rome and poured through St. Peter's Square in those days. What was so remarkable about that experience weren't just the massive numbers. I mean, that, of course, was imminently predictable. This was one of the global superstars of his time, a man who inspired not only deep spiritual devotion, but even among non-Catholics and non-believers, enormous respect for his contributions across a wide range of issues. So the fact that there would be a massive global response to his death was hardly a shocker. But I think what was most surprising was this enormously prayerful atmosphere in the crowd that with a crowd that size, you just don't expect. And I think it was incredibly striking. I'll tell you one story that I think brought home the spirit of that experience for me. I was doing the color commentary for CNN, and so, you know, one of the things you do in these experiences is you look for the Americans in the crowd and you do interviews with them. We found a guy who had come over from Chicago. He had heard that the Pope had died, had packed a bag and got on a plane. He was expecting to pay his respects to the body, spend 2 or 3 days in Rome, and then go home. Instead, he landed at Fiumicino, got in a taxi, went to St. Peter's Square, stood in line for almost 48 hours in order to try to get his those fleeting few seconds in front of the Pope's body. And then given his schedule, he had to get back in a cab as soon as he was done with our interview, go back to Fiumicino, and go home. And he told us it was the most powerful experience of his life. And I think in my microcosm, that was the story of those days, just the kind of ineradicable spiritual connection people felt with this man, which was multiplied by millions of times. It was a remarkable period of time.
Well, since then, we've had 6 more years go on. We've had almost 6 years of Pope Benedict and his pontificate, and, you know, he's been doing new things, and time has marched on. How much is the memory of Pope John Paul still just as alive?
Well, I think John Paul II was one of those sort of rare players on the global stage whose memory it may dim slightly, but his star still burns fairly bright and probably will for some time to come. And I think proof of that would be, first of all, the fact that media organizations around the world are gearing up to cover the beatification as if it's Game 7 of the NBA Finals or as if it's the World Cup Final. There is a wide consensus that this man was a newsmaker and remains a newsmaker. So I think in the court of popular opinion, you still have that. But in terms of internal Catholic reactions, let's not forget that we now have an entire generation of younger bishops, of priests, and of lay people who would explicitly describe themselves and think of themselves as John Paul II Catholics. I mean, in effect, the generation that is now coming into leadership in the church is the John Paul II generation. So I think, if nothing else, that in itself is a kind of guarantor that the John Paul stamp on the church is not about to lose its hold.
Okay, looking back at the man himself, what, for you, were his greatest gifts, his most lasting legacy?
Well, when you start talking about the legacy of John Paul II, the question really is, where do you begin? Because it is so profound across such a wide range of areas. I mean, we can start with the obvious, his role in the collapse of communism, his groundbreaking pioneering successes in outreach to other religions, in particular to Judaism and Islam. And I think that merits a moment's pause, because if you think about the staggering historical improbability of that he would manage to be a pioneer both in relations with Jews and with Muslims at the same time in a world in which that's usually a zero-sum game. That is, a step towards the Jews often comes at the expense of your relationship with Muslims and vice versa. The fact that he was able to do that in the same historical moment is really quite remarkable. In terms of his impact inside the church, one could talk about a great many things, but I think fundamentally what John Paul will be remembered for is sort of restoring the Catholic swagger, that is the sort of pride and self-confidence in being Catholic. After a period in the 70s when that seemed to dim somewhat. Now, you know, obviously, that sense of boldness and brashness and pride in one's Catholic identity has suffered a great deal in the years since because of the sexual abuse crisis. But it is still there in that generation of John Paul II bishops and priests and lay activists in a way that simply didn't exist prior to his papacy, the beginning of his papacy in October 1978. So in virtually every sense one could imagine, I think, his impact was deep and profound and lasting.
And when you use the word lasting, I think also of his travels. He was, of course, by far the most travelled pope in history. And we can't really imagine now a pope that wouldn't travel, right? I mean, he's laid down the standard on that.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, in the old days, and of course by the old days now, I'm talking about prior to Pope Paul VI, it was sort of a revolution if the pope ever left the Vatican. And Paul VI, of course, took a small number of highly symbolic voyages to the different continents, and that laid the template. But it was John Paul II who brought all that to fruition. You'll recall at the beginning of his papacy, John Paul said that he felt himself not merely to be the successor of St. Peter in the sense of the governor of the universal church, but also the successor of St. Paul, that is, the evangelist and the missionary who had hit the highways and byways of the world to try to bring the gospel to the people. And he clearly did that. What I remember as a Vatican reporter is that in the twilight of John Paul's papacy, that is, his final years, prior to every trip, we would always write stories about the pope's health and how there were worries that this trip might compromise his health. By the end of the trip, we would inevitably be writing stories about how much better he seemed. And the point there is that I think John Paul II actually drew energy from the road. I mean, he was the kind of populist leader who needed to be out there in the streets and in the marketplace in order to come alive. And it was quite remarkable on those final trips. Day one, you would always see him frail and tired and struggling to complete his texts. By the end, he would always seem a new man. And I think in microcosm, that was the story of his papacy. He was a pope who drew energy from contact with the world.
I was speaking to John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and Vatican analyst for CNN.
Hey, John Paul, we can finish the race for you. Hey, John Paul, we can carry the flame within. Taught us how to forgive the past. Taught us about saying sorry. Taught us how to carry the flame and run to the ends of the earth. Fighting
continues in Libya. What are the pros and cons of the international military intervention there, and its implications for the wider region? And what is the end game, assuming this intervention were to lead to the removal of the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi? And how is all this likely to impact on the often embattled Christian minorities in the Middle Eastern region? These are some of the questions being hotly debated as we watch scenes of the conflict in Libya and hear continuing reports of anti-government unrest in other countries of the area. Harry Hagopian is a consultant on Mideast affairs for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. I asked him whether he believed the military intervention in Libya can be justified on moral grounds.
Well, I mean, in my opinion, the first moral responsibility we had in the West is to stop the violence that could have been on a horrific scale had the pro-Gaddafi forces managed to enter Benghazi. So in a sense, with the United Nations Security Council resolution providing the legal mandate for the protection of the Libyan civilians, I think basically what the Allied operations did was to prevent what could have been large-scale massacres had the forces entered the country.
Nonetheless, there are a lot of people who are somewhat concerned about this military intervention. And, you know, the cynics are saying, well, the West only seems to intervene in Muslim countries and usually those who have oil. And they're also worried about how this whole situation will play out. I mean, do you share those concerns?
Yes, of course I share those concerns. Everybody shares those concerns, and it's quite evident for the people I speak with in the Middle East that they sometimes detect double standards in some of the campaigns waged by the West as they see it, Iraq and Libya being two oil-producing countries, whereas other countries such as Syria, Bahrain, or Yemen, nobody is really making much of a noise about them. So in that sense, yes, I do understand the concern, and I also do understand the misgivings of some people, not only in the Middle East, but also in Europe and here in the United Kingdom. However, I would also say that two wrongs do not make one right, in the sense that at least if we can manage to help Libya restore itself to a sense of openness and protect its civilian population without necessarily creating a further civil war in the country, and if we manage to subscribe ourselves to the mandate that was provided by the United Nations Security Council resolution, then in a sense, I think that Operation Odyssey Dawn would be able, at the very least, to prevent further civilian killings and hopefully open the way for a freer and more open, transparent, and democratic society. Now, is this going to happen? Or, as some cynics say, would it lead to a split of Libya into two? Would it create more mayhem? I don't think anybody can be a prophet at this stage to foretell what could happen in the future. However, there is a kind of a murky, hazy vision there leading this operation. And I think if it is proportionate to the needs, if we have an objective, if we have a reasonable hope for success, and if we also are convinced that peace would ensue after the war, then not only are we doing something that is legal and moral, but we're also coming fairly closely, as the U.S. Catholic bishop said in a statement, quite close to our own understanding of the Augustinian principles of a just war.
What about the situation for Christians? How do Christians living in the area feel about the Libyan intervention? Aren't they worried that this could be seen as yet another example of the Christian West intervening in a Muslim country, and this could create a backlash for them?
Well, in a sense, this is always the case. Whenever there are such disturbances or attacks or wars, the indigenous local Christians of the region, who are in their majority Arab ethnically, are always viewed with suspicion because there is this combination of ethnicity and indigenous belonging with a faith that many people in the Middle East perceive as a Western faith. So look at what's happened to the Christians in Iraq. They've been suffering through horrendous persecution since the last 8-9 years when we attacked and invaded Iraq. So the same thing could be said on many other different levels in many other different countries. So whilst the Arab Christians of the region suffer the same discrimination and the same problems and difficulties as do the majority Muslim populations, yet in a sense, in the words that Colonel Gaddafi is using by calling this a crusade, a plot against Islam, equating Al-Qaeda with the West in terms of the objectives of Odyssey Dawn, I think he is trying to foment that kind of anti-West division for which the local Christians would inevitably pay a price in some way or another. So this is one of the fears that we in the Catholic Bishops' Conference are very worried about. We follow very, very closely what is happening and try in as much as possible to speak out whenever we see this happening, be it in Iraq, be it with the Coptic Christians in Egypt, be it with all the other Christians. And remember, there are about 15 million Christians in the Middle East who belong to that region.
I was speaking to Harry Hagopian, an Armenian from Jerusalem, who is the consultant on Mideast Affairs for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Well,
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus. Mm-hmm.